we can go ahead and get started again. MEI is particularly honored today to welcome Senator Chris Coons from the state of Delaware, who serves as a member of the Foreign Relations Committee and Appropriations Committee. And I guess we should also express our gratitude to Senator McConnell for not screwing up your calendar any more today than necessary. Senator Coons has generously agreed to join us today to offer his own insights into critical Iran issues, including those related to two items that are currently on the Senate agenda. First is the status of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, treating Iran's program and sanctions relief. And then the second is the Countering Iran's Destabilizing Activities Act of 2017. We look forward as well to hearing the Senator's thoughts on events in the region, including Iran's presidential election, tensions between the GCC states, and developments in the Syrian conflict. I'll have a few questions for the Senator here on the stage after his remarks, but both he and we want to maximize the time available for audience questions until he must return to the Capitol, leaving here hard stop at 2:30. So I'll stop talking and invite Senator Coons to come to the podium.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you, Jerry, for the introduction and the opportunity to be with you today. And thank you for the way that you served the country and the State Department for more than 40 years, culminating with your admirable service as our ambassador to Yemen and a top official in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs. And my thanks to the Middle East Institute and to all of you, those of you who are serving or who have served in the State Department as civil servants or foreign service officers. We're grateful for all that you do or have done to advocate on behalf of the United States and our interests and values. And I'd also like to thank other members of the diplomatic corps, members of the press who are here today, and folks who either serve in our armed forces or who are part of the press corps or the nonprofit community that is so robust here in the DuPont Circle area. I'd also like to thank Tom and Adam and Ryan, folks in my team, who helped craft and focus my thoughts on U.S.-Iran policy. This afternoon, I want to talk about Iran's recent behavior and U.S. policy towards Iran. I'll discuss the current status of the U.S.-Iran relationship and how we have reached our current state of increased tension. I'll lay out some policy recommendations and make the case that war between our nations is not inevitable and calls for regime change at this time are ill-advised. Tensions between the United States and Iran have increased steadily since President Trump took office in January. Both Iranian and U.S. government actions have contributed to this dynamic. Let's begin by reviewing Iran's recent behavior. The Iranian government has continued its ballistic missile tests. The regime regularly violates the human rights of its people. Its leaders continue to call for Israel's destruction and test just how close they can move proxy fighters to Israel's borders with Syria. In addition to Syria, the IRGC Quds Force continues to foment instability in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, and Afghanistan. Iran continues to fund Hezbollah, Hamas, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad with tens of millions of dollars. As Ramadan ended, Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei called the fight against Zionism obligatory for all Muslims. And last month, Iran marked Quds Day with large rallies at which protesters chanted the familiar death to Israel, death to America. In May and June, U.S. military forces in the region, both in Syria and the Gulf, found themselves in very close calls with Iranian ships, aircraft, and proxy forces. And on May 19th, Iran held elections, elections that I would say were neither free nor fair. Each of all of these different destabilizing or dangerous or disappointing actions has contributed to increased friction between the United States and Iran. Before we consider how the Trump administration has responded, it's important to acknowledge that the Trump administration's strategy review towards Iran is ongoing. As I understand it, the review is occurring in a thorough and professional manner, but we've already received some indications of the way that President Trump and his team intend to approach Iran. I believe the administration has taken appropriate action in a few cases, to defend U.S. military assets and our partners in Syria and the Gulf. The April 6th strike on Bashar al-Assad's military facilities appears to have deterred possible additional chemical weapons attacks. These actions demonstrate to Iran and its proxies that there are consequences for challenging American military operations and international norms, such as the Chemical Weapons Convention. More generally, the National Security Advisor, Secretary of State, and Secretary of Defense rightly caution against walking away from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA, at least for now. I believe they are correct in concluding that upholding the JCPOA and condemning Iran's behavior are not mutually exclusive. But I have grave concerns about how the Trump administration has handled other aspects of its engagement with Iran. Just 7 days into his term, President Trump fulfilled a campaign promise by putting in place a ban on individuals traveling to the United States from Iran and six other Muslim-majority countries. The Iranian government has taken advantage of this travel ban to accelerate its efforts to promote widespread anti-Americanism. Since the ban was announced, close observers of Iran have reported a widespread rise in anti-American sentiment among the Iranian people, who previously widely held a more favorable view of our country. The president further worsened tensions following the June 7th ISIS attack on the Iranian parliament. In his statement following that attack, President Trump said that states that sponsor terrorism risk falling victim to the evil they promote. And I frankly think it wasn't constructive to suggest that Iran invites ISIS attacks because of its government's actions. More broadly, President Trump has taken a one-sided approach to the region. His visit to Riyadh and reflexive support of Saudi Arabia in its feud with Qatar are at the broadest level counterproductive. Leaders in Tehran are boasting about how the ongoing GCC feud is weakening the anti-Iran bloc in the Gulf and unnecessarily distracting our Arab partners. The crisis hurts our ability to respond to Iranian aggression in the Middle East. There should be no doubt that I view many of Iran's actions as inexcusable, and I believe they require a clear-eyed and persistent response from the United States. But it's also apparent from the examples I've just cited that President Trump's actions have also contributed to an increasingly tense state of U.S.-Iranian relations. The question before us is, how do we craft a policy towards Iran that pushes back against its bad actions while avoiding counterproductive moves or inadvertent steps that lead towards a greater conflict? The Senate has already taken action to respond to Iranian aggression. On June 15th, by a vote of 98-2, we passed a bill to impose non-nuclear sanctions on both Russia and Iran. I was proud to be an original co-sponsor of this bill, which will impose terrorism-related sanctions on the IRGC, hold Iran's government accountable for its human rights record, and allow for sanctions on supporters of Iran's illicit ballistic missile activity. This bill will take real steps to punish Iran for its unacceptable non-nuclear behavior without undermining the JCPOA. The House should pass it, and President Trump should sign it immediately. This brings me to the JCPOA, signed almost exactly 2 years ago. I supported the agreement, although I haven't shied away from pointing out where I thought it needed to be strengthened and in pointing out its challenges, weaknesses, or flaws. Despite its imperfections, the JCPOA has so far achieved its fundamental goal of freezing Iran's nuclear weapons program. The agreement remains in the best interest of the United States because it keeps our allies on our side. It helps us gather valuable intelligence on Iran's ongoing nuclear program. It allows for intrusive and sustained inspections. It sustains limited, useful communications challenges with the Iranian government. And it is one of the more successful global actions in counterproliferation. Let me speak specifically about the importance of these communications channels. As I suspect this audience knows better than any, for decades, the United States and Iran did not communicate directly, leading to misunderstandings and unintended escalation. I'm skeptical that the communications channels created by the JCPOA can single-handedly achieve any diplomatic breakthroughs, but they are critical to preventing miscommunication between the United States and Iran. And so I urge the Trump administration not to casually shut them down or cast them aside. We can use these channels proactively. We should use them to make sure the Iranian government more clearly understands which behaviors we find unacceptable including, for example, violations of the JCPOA, provocative actions against our military assets in the Gulf, attacks against Israel, and Iran's ongoing support for the regime of Bashar al-Assad. We should also use these communications channels to press Iran to release detained and missing Americans, including Robert Levinson and Simak and Bakir Namazi. The JCPOA also buys us time while Iran does not possess a nuclear weapon. Rather than tear up the deal, as some have suggested, the United States should keep working diligently with our allies, as well as with countries such as China and Russia, that although being adversaries in other sectors, were our partners in this deal, to negotiate a successor agreement that will expand upon the current inspections regime. Some of the JCPOA's restrictions expire as soon as 8 years from now. So we need to think today about how we might monitor and constrain Iran's nuclear program after provisions of the JCPOA sunset. Sanctioning Iran and upholding the JCPOA do not constitute a fully formed U.S.-Iran policy. A third pillar has to involve maintaining and enhancing our cooperation with critical regional partners. We have no more important regional partner than Israel, the only true democracy in the Middle East. We must sustain our cooperation on missile defense and fully fund Israel's security assistance. Other Middle Eastern security partners, such as the UAE, have contributed to our fight against Iranian proxies, against ISIS, and against Al-Qaeda. We should continue to support them. And if other countries are willing to partner in a manner consistent with our respect for the law of armed conflict and human rights, we should explore new and expanded ways to work together. Finally, in our rhetoric, as well as our actions, the United States has to continue to distinguish between the Iranian people and their government. Rather than banning most Iranians from traveling to the United States or blaming them when they are victims of a terrorist attack, I think Americans should maintain our expressed support for the people of Iran. In May, Iranians once again endured long lines to vote in an election, even when they knew it was neither free nor fair. The people of Iran welcomed members of the U.S. wrestling team with open arms, even during our ongoing dispute over the president's travel ban. The Iranian people must know and trust that our concerns, our disagreements, are with their government, not with their culture or their religion. Before I conclude, I'd like to sound a note of caution about recent calls from some to pursue regime change in Iran. The United States will always maintain, must always maintain, our right to use military force to protect our interests and the security of vital regional allies such as Israel. But war with Iran is not inevitable, and regime change in Iran should not be the stated policy of the United States. For those who are suggesting such a course, even urging it, I ask them to be wary, particularly given our recent track record in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya. Regime change, in my view, would be unlikely to succeed. I think we shouldn't stumble into a new conflict while still trying to manage our anti-ISIS campaign, our conflict with North Korea, the rise of China, and an increasingly and expansively belligerent Russia. President Trump himself called regime change dangerous and wasteful during his campaign in 2016. If we did pursue this ill-advised approach, what would the result look like? Would terrorist groups fill the vacuum created by instability inside Iran? What would be the impact on markets and on the free flow of energy and on relations with the West and throughout the Persian Gulf? More importantly, what would be the composition of a successor regime? Would an alternative government be stable and seen as legitimate by the Iranian people, or would it be more likely seen as a Western-backed puppet? There are far more questions with either troublesome or bad answers than there are questions with good answers in this scenario. I think if our recent experience teaches us anything, it's that we should consider what follows the use of military force in the Middle East and approach these decisions with humility. Let me conclude with a final thought. I do not trust the Iranian regime, and I vehemently oppose their behavior in the region. But we can respond effectively by passing and enforcing tough non-nuclear sanctions while maintaining engagement with the Iranian government and demonstrating support for the Iranian people. Today, the United States and our partners are showing our commitment to nuclear non-proliferation in the face of North Korea's ongoing missile tests and nuclear tests. I believe there is value in enforcing the JCPOA and demonstrating a viable diplomatic alternative to the pursuit of nuclear weapons. calls for regime change or war with Iran are reckless. A collision course with Iran is not inevitable, and we can and must avoid stumbling into military conflict. We should preserve all diplomatic channels and exhaust all options before seriously considering any action involving military force. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today, and Jerry, I look forward to our conversation and to your questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Senator Coons. Thank you very much for your comments. Just a couple of questions to kick it off before we turn to the audience for their questions. You had talked about the presidential election and noted that it was neither free nor fair. And that, of course, the options, the opportunities for the Iranian people to really choose representatives that reflected their own desires were very restricted, limited. A lot of people, of course, look at the election of Hassan Rouhani, nevertheless, as a signal that the Iranian people are really committed to and interested in a more moderate approach, an approach that's quite different from the hardline IRGC and Ayatollah Khamenei view of the world. How do you see the election of Rouhani, and do you believe that it opens opportunities for the United States to pursue some of the kinds of openings and the communications that you advocated?
So, as I said, we need to distinguish between how we view the Iranian regime and the Iranian people. Even though every single candidate was vetted by the Guardian Council, the 12-member panel stocked with loyalists to the Supreme Leader and committed to the preservation of the Islamic Republic, the Iranian people stood in very long lines, participated mm-hmm. enthusiastically, and have now, I think, two elections in a row signaled that they want a regime that is less repressive. They want a more open society. They want more contact with the outside world. And I think we should recognize respond to the faith that they seem to be expressing in engagement with the world. But we also have to be clear-eyed about the ongoing actions of the IRGC, of the Quds Force, and of some of the more hardline elements in the regime. So I don't think an appropriate response is to ban Iranians from coming to the United States or to blame them when there's an ISIS attack on their country. You know, Iran expressed solidarity with the United States following 9/11. I do think there are ways that we can and should explore closer relations with Iran, but that's really best done in people-to-people exchanges while still being clear-eyed about the very real threat that the Iranian regime presents to our interests and our values.
Absolutely. And a little bit later on, of course, the first panel looked a little bit at the military challenges that Iran poses to us and to our friends and partners in the region. Later on, we'll be talking a little bit about how Iran is engaged in expanding its role, its influence in Iraq and in Syria and Lebanon and in Yemen. We're, of course, looking in the immediate period at what seems to be a very significant victory in Mosul, the defeat of the Islamic State, where both the United States and Iran had reason to take some satisfaction in the efforts that we've all made to achieve that. There is concern about where the Iranians see their future role in Iraq and whether they intend to try to establish in Mosul and other of the liberated territories a foothold that's going to continue to influence Iraqi behavior going forward. How do you see Mosul and what happens after this?
Well, I'm very concerned that we may repeat a pattern of winning the war and losing the peace. It is worth pausing for a moment and celebrating the fall of Mosul and a significant defeat of ISIS, really one of the most despicable medieval, in the most negative sense of the term, terrorist organizations in modern history. And the fact that we had sort of a shared interest in a common enemy and that we've made real progress in liberating Mosul, we should celebrate. But I have grave concerns about what Iranian-allied Shia militias will now do. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I think this is an incredibly ill-advised time for deep cuts to the State Department and USAID. I think it was Secretary Mattis himself who said that we need to complement military resources, prowess, and success with investments in development and diplomacy. If we don't find ways to help stabilize and restore civilian rule in Mosul and quickly bring back some sense of normalcy and yet assert our interest in democracy and human rights, I think we will all too quickly see Iranian power projection into Mosul and into Iraq even further. I'm concerned by previous Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki running for election. He seemed to me to rule or govern in a way that really aligned with Iran, and that led to a lot of his lack of success. And while al-Abadi is not perfect, he certainly has governed in a more balanced way. And I think that Iran's strategic objective of having a secure land bridge through northern Iraq through which it can ship weapons and support to Hezbollah and to its allied forces in Syria means that we have to really pay close attention to this and be engaged. We cannot simply say Mosul is liberated and walk away. And our diplomats and our development professionals are absolutely essential in this work, and that's one of the reasons on the Foreign Relations Committee and the Appropriations Committee I'm fighting to make sure that we don't at this particularly pivotal time enact the devastating and I think ill-advised cuts that were proposed in the president's budget.
No, absolutely. I can say from my own experience that unless you have a comprehensive approach to dealing with these issues, you never actually achieve a sustainable solution. You'll never get to the objective of defeating violent extremism unless you are prepared to commit for the long term to the kind of development and peacemaking approach that requires a robust State Department and USAID. Let me ask members of our audience. We have about 20 minutes for the senator before he has to leave, and so let me offer opportunities to our audience members. We start here with this gentleman in the blue. We have microphones coming around. Please identify yourselves before you ask your question.
Peter Humphrey. I'm an intelligence analyst and a former diplomat. My problem with anti-regime change people is that you basically condemn hundreds of thousands of people to torture and imprisonment for generations, and that's unacceptable to me personally. So I want to know what happens when the Iranian people take to the streets in massive numbers, even massive numbers than the last time. Do you non-regime change people sit on the sidelines once again? Is it once again Hungary in 1956? Or will you actually help the young people who have indicated over and over again in both open and clandestine polling that they don't want this regime? Do you side with those people, or do you let it go on this principle of non-interference?
Well, I don't think I articulated a principle of non-interference. I think what I was suggesting was if you look at the menu of challenges the United States faces in the world today, and in the context of a new administration that is proposing deep cuts in our capabilities, both diplomatic and developmental, I am concerned that there are those who are sort of banging the drum for a regime change effort now. So I'm not someone who is a non-interventionist in all contexts at all times. I agree with you that it is achingly difficult to look back at periods where the United States did not engage as hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets and sought opportunities to participate in their society. But the outcome of the so-called Arab Spring broadly has been uneven. The United States' role in a variety of the conflicts that have come out of it isn't clearly positive. And I'd welcome input from you on how else you would suggest we engage with the Iranian regime. I think we're coming from a similar place of saying the current Iranian regime has human rights practices internally that are despicable and does not reflect the will of the Iranian people. But what I was trying to point to was, in a very difficult time, when we are overextended and under-resourced to confront really imminent threats, today, this year, this is not the time to be beginning a drumbeat for regime change without having thought through how we would accomplish that, what the consequences would be for the Iranian people and the region, and then how that would reflect on the United States. I think our recent past is not filled with examples of successful regime change efforts by the United States.
Okay.
That's all. Somehow I got 10 times as many questions.
Okay. Let's come over here.
Thank you, Senator. Niels Barzani from Iraqi Kurdistan Representation Office in D.C. I think no one can deny the fact that since the 2003 liberation, Iran's influence has increasingly grown in all over Iraq, and the only part that Iran's influence is very limited is the Kurdistan region of Iraq, the Iraqi Kurdistan. Iraqi Kurdistan recently decided to hold a referendum on independence in September 25th, within 2 months, and the ultimate objective is to declare independence and secede from Iraq. This Iranian government has already expressed their strong opposition on this move, and we have heard a statement from the State Department that saying the timing of the referendum is not good. I would like to hear your views on that and how the U.S. should approach this referendum and ultimate independence for the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Thank you.
That is one of the most difficult questions posed in the region. Because on the one hand, you have the legitimate yearning of the Kurdish people for a vehicle for their own political self-governance and expression across several countries, with the intense tensions, even conflict, that inspires with several countries. Obviously, most critically, our NATO ally, Turkey, who is an essential partner in our work against ISIS. My predecessor in my current seat, Vice President Joe Biden, rather famously advocated for a reconfiguration of Iraq that would allow for more independence regionally, and was willing to publicly contemplate a redrawing of the lines that go back to the 1920s. I hesitate to endorse any initiative that leads to the dismembering of Iraq, exactly because I'm not sure that there is a way that the Sunni and Shia majority portions of Iraq remain viable or independent and are anything other than a field for Iranian expansion in the absence of the Kurdish portion of Iraq that provides critical stability. My personal hope, and I'm simply expressing my hope, is that Iraq could find success as a federal republic where the Kurdish people have the degree of autonomy, self-governance, and stability that could make possible if it were governed in an even-handed and effective way. I recognize that the experience under Prime Minister Maliki was not positive for much of the country, and a national government that really acts as an extension of Iranian interests or as a Shia government is deeply burdensome to the Kurdish people, and that the Kurdish people have fought valiantly and have in many ways carried much of the struggle of expelling ISIS from Mosul and are on the front lines of the fight in Raqqa. So the claim to having an opportunity at the outcome of this brutal conflict to self-governance is one that, you know, echoes in some of the most ancient and fundamental calling that people have, which is for self-determination. I don't have a good answer for what we should do next, depending on the outcome of the referendum. My gut instinct is to support the integrity of Iraq, but I would recognize, should you immediately challenge that point, that that is simply freezing in place lines drawn on a map decades ago by now faded colonial powers, and that the legitimacy of those lines, other than once we begin erasing lines in one corner, then lines all over the world are questioned. The legitimacy of those lines is fundamentally a question, and that is one of the drivers of conflict in the region. But I appreciate the question, and clearly I have some homework to do.
Barbara.
Thanks. Barbara Slavin from the Atlantic Council. Senator, what is your view about what is going to happen in Syria? It seems that the Trump administration is basically going to cede much of the initiative to Russia and Iran and maybe maintain a small zone along the border with Israel and Jordan for whatever forces the U.S. is supporting, some sort of buffer zone. Is that how you see it, and is that the optimal result given what's going on in the region?
I don't know and can't speak to what the Trump administration's strategy is in Syria. The Trump administration owes us a strategy in Syria, in Iraq, a policy with regards to the JCPOA and the U.S.-Iran relationship, and a clearer path forward in Afghanistan. I recognize that the first 6 months of the administration has been somewhat tumultuous. They've been distracted by some other developments. And it's one of the reasons, I think, that the State Department, Secretary Tillerson, urgently needs to fill that next layer of assistant secretaries, the sorts of folks who would be critical to providing the diplomatic side of that strategy. I'm someone, to your previous point about non-intervention, who urged more active, more aggressive engagement by the United States against Bashar al-Assad several years ago under the previous administration. Syria is an enormous tragedy. It is a great failing, I think, by the international community, and it has produced one of the greatest refugee waves in known human history. And it will leave scars that will last for generations. Finding a way that we can produce some stability, some cessation of violence, and yet hold accountable those who are responsible for atrocities on a scale unseen in decades would be my hope for goal. I don't see how that's accomplishable without an American role. I see America not as the only world policeman or essential country, but I don't see how our interests and values are advanced by simply allowing Russia and Iran to figure out what is most to their interests in terms of either sustaining the murderous regime of Bashar al-Assad or carving up the country into zones. I won't quibble with the prioritization of bringing ISIS to an end first and then addressing the challenges in the rest of Syria. And I recognize the intense difficulty of having Turkey engaged in a constructive way while still having profound differences in our view of the YPG and of the Kurdish people and their role both in Syria and in the region. But we have to be at the table, and we have to help frame the path forward. And we have to be invested in the recovery and the stabilization and the rehabilitation of Syria. It was one of the most remarkably multi-faith countries in the region with an ancient and admirable culture known as a nation of learning. What has happened in Syria is something we should all grieve over, and that the United States could just sort of walk away and say we have other things that we need to tend to, I think just would not reflect well on the United States.
Okay. Let's go back here. And then take a few.
Mohammed Tahir from Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. My question would be about Afghanistan. What do you think of President Trump's strategy towards Afghanistan? What do you know about it? And the only thing we know so far is a few thousand soldiers might be heading to Afghanistan. Soon, are you in line with this idea? Thank you.
Often militaries historically have been questioned or criticized for fighting the last war, for preparing for the last conflict rather than the current conflict. And often political leaders define themselves in opposition to their predecessor rather than in the context they're in. President Trump, I think, in a sense of urgency to define himself in opposition to his predecessor, has made a big point of devolving to combatant commanders operational decisions. Contrary to his predecessor, who he criticized justly or not, as being over-engaged in operational decisions. I think it is the commander-in-chief's responsibility to devise, explain, and defend a strategy. I don't quibble with whether or not the combatant commander should be able to deploy forces or weapons at a certain scale, but a choice about whether we are committed to Afghanistan and will increase our troop strength and call upon our vital NATO allies, our ISAF partners, to sustain their engagement in partnership with the Afghan government, that's a commander-in-chief question. And that President Trump has really largely given that decision to the combatant commander or the Secretary of Defense, I think, is stepping aside from his responsibility. And it leaves unanswered the question whether he fully supports a sustained and longer-term engagement. The challenge here is that in the absence of some negotiated peace and role with the Taliban that achieves a political solution, I don't see how peace is achievable within the next year or two or three in Afghanistan. And I'm waiting to hear articulated by the administration, what's their theory of the case? What is their strategic argument for how a few thousand more American troops will make a decisive difference? It's really not a few thousand troops, I don't think. I think what is being debated internally within the administration is an open-ended commitment by the United States. And my hunch is that we either will or will not hear a statement that the United States and our NATO partners are committed to supporting and sustaining the Afghan national security forces and the Afghan government or not. And I don't think they've actually made a final decision on that. And I think quibbling over whether it's 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 troops is less important than that fundamental strategic decision. Are we committed for the long haul to ensuring the stability of the Afghan government? I don't have an answer to that question in terms of what President Trump, our commander-in-chief, believes. But it is also critically connected to our view of NATO. The only time Article 5 has been invoked was in defense of the United States and jointly with us in the conduct of this campaign in Afghanistan. And I think at a time when the president, not his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State, who've made very forceful statements, but our president has not yet persuaded our NATO partners that we're all in NATO, we can't advance that argument in Afghanistan without also answering the question, are we really fully, firmly committed to NATO? I am, but I'm not the commander-in-chief. I'm just a senator. The person who is the president of the United States needs to affirmatively answer that question first before he can deliver a strategy for Afghanistan.
Okay. Let's take two last questions very quickly. Amal and the gentleman in the check shirt in the back. A short question, please.
That you are concerned about losing the peace. That you're concerned about losing the peace in Iraq after the defeat of ISIS. There are reports today of revenge by Iranian-backed militias of the civilian population, and the UN Human Rights Commissioner spoke about that. What is the role of the United States to prevent this from happening and to prevent the repeat of what caused the rise of ISIS that Sunni population will feel now it's under threat? Thank you. And is there a role for Congress in that? Thank you.
Okay. And then this gentleman in the back, and that will be it.
Thank you. Aaron Zucker, Johns Hopkins SAIS. Senator, you and some of your colleagues have supported the JCPOA, but also supported sanctions to hold Iran accountable for its other activities. My understanding is some of your other colleagues have sought to use sanctions to scuttle the JCPOA. How do you thread that needle? How do we hold Iran accountable without sending signals that we don't support the deal? Thank you.
That's a great question. I'll talk to that first and then this second, if I might. That is a very important and delicate balance. I ultimately supported the JCPOA as the least bad option on the table. And in part, that's because the rest of the world community, in response to American leadership, had over several years gotten to a point of imposing aggressive sanctions against Iran, concluding an agreement, and being in a place where they were ready to proceed. By the time it came to Congress and the Senate for review and a decision, after talking to ambassadors and security leaders from several of our vital partners around the world, I became convinced we didn't have the option at that point of leaving the table, going back to the beginning, and renegotiating a tougher, longer deal. Given that, I tried to be clear-eyed about its limitations and what it offered. Much of what it offered has been fulfilled, but we have to stay on it. We have to be diligent. We can't use minor excursions from the boundaries of the JCPOA as an excuse to walk away from it. We have to be diligent and thorough on insisting that the IAEA have the resources for inspections, that where there are temporary excursions or refusals for inspections, that we're on it and we're aggressive and we're engaged. And we should only break the agreement or walk away from the agreement when there is clear cause to do so. We won't get searching inspections, the partnership of most of the rest of the developed world, China, Russia, and the EU, our core partners, and we won't get the freeze on Iran's enrichment activities that this agreement made possible if we walk away. So we have to be clear-eyed about what the consequences are, because there are several of my colleagues who are actively looking to tank this deal and to go back to, I think, a trend line of inevitable conflict with Iran, which I hope I persuasively laid out is not in our short-term or possibly long-term interest at all. I think it is a flawed construct, but the best option we have. But we need to maintain our focus on it and invest in the intelligence resources, the diplomatic resources, the development resources to be successful over the long term in moving towards a different future and a different trajectory between the American and Iranian people. Lebanon, you know, one of the things I try to express repeatedly is gratitude for the people of Lebanon, of Turkey, of Jordan, who have an enormous hospitality challenge because there are millions of refugees. There's many other countries in the region as well, but the immediate adjacent countries have taken on millions of refugees. And I am concerned about the stability within Lebanon and within Jordan as a result. We've got some very painful lessons from the conflict in Iraq and the ways in which you might have been able to predict the rise of ISIS because of what happened under Maliki and because of some of the revenge killings and the aggressive expansion of the Shia militia. I think the United States has both the opportunity and a responsibility to be engaged in ensuring stability and a restoration of something like a functioning federal republic in Iraq. The challenge is the patience of the American people and the engagement of our president and his leadership team. They have not articulated a U.S. strategy with regards to Iraq and Syria, but to do so without being clear-eyed about the ways in which the last conflict in Iraq, and the last American engagement in Iraq, almost inevitably led to the rise of ISIS. To miss that and to repeat that would be to waste the sacrifice of so many who've been on the front lines of the fight that has now apparently liberated Mosul. The United States was dragged back in by the extent to which ISIS is brutal and aggressive. There will be another ISIS if we don't provide, in partnership with regional allies, some path towards stability and security for the Sunni people, the Kurdish people, and the Shia people, among many others, of Iraq. Iraq is a very difficult constellation of many faiths. I listed only three, but there are, of course, many others. It's a hard puzzle to solve, but we can't repeat the mistake of winning the war and losing the peace. Jerry, it's been wonderful to be with you, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you all very much for asking very difficult questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator. We can only hope that the administration listens to our queer-eyed friends on the Hill.